Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. This year is the 40th anniversary of the UK Championship, one of snooker's longest running and most prestigious events, been won by so many great names down the years. And there's no one better than the Snooker Scene editor, Clive Everton, to reminisce about some of the great matches, some of the great champions that this great tournament has produced. So the first UK Championship was 1977, and I guess at that point, because snooker was starting to become more popular, there was a need for new tournaments, and Mike Watterson, I guess the promoter, felt that he was the man to sort of start delivering different events.
Yes, it got off to a rather uncertain start. Mike was mindful of the fact that the World Championships, or some of the World Championships of the 40s and 50s, had taken place at Blackpool Tower Circus, and he thought and had attracted, you know, big crowds day after day. So he thought, we'll go there. But of course, they went in the week before winter, before Christmas rather, in the dead of winter. So attendances were quite poor for the first UK Championship, which was won by Patsy Fagan. But for the second year, Mike obtained the sponsorship of Corals, who stayed with the event for quite a few seasons, actually. And that was won by Doug Mountjoy.
Let's talk about Patsy Fagan, because he was a very sort of well-known player in the London area, and he's talked about sort of the money matches he played and was very well regarded. But that was obviously his only real success, and it was kind of sad in the end what happened to him, wasn't it? He developed a problem using the wrist.
Yeah, he just couldn't hit the ball. Mm. It's the equivalent of dartitis, where the player can't let go of the arrow, and it was really painful to watch him taking on all sorts of shots, so that he just didn't have to use the wrist. He did get over it to some extent, eventually, but he was never as good as when he won the UK and one or two other events around about that time.
He's in good shape now, actually. We see him quite often in tournaments, indeed in the audience, although there was one occasion where on the BBC where Dennis Taylor identified Patsy Fagan, and it wasn't him, it was someone else who looked nothing like him. But anyway, that's a side issue. So Preston, obviously, I mean, that's the venue that it became associated with in the 80s. Was there a feeling when you got to Preston that this is a proper place for it?
Absolutely. I think Preston is a very good venue for a final or a semi-final with one table, but it's an even better venue in an eight table situation, because you can walk around the top balcony and look at lots of matches. And I think it was also very good that the UK was specifically associated with Preston. It helped give the event a sense of identity, which it lost when it left Preston and tried one or two other venues before it ended up at the Barbican in York.
It was good for Preston as well, I think. The Guildhall is different now. A lot of the shops around it have shut down, and I know this is true of a lot of places in the north of England, but it gave the city an identity as well, or the town an identity. So 1980, Steve Davis, that was his big breakthrough. I mean, he was kind of, I guess, earmarked for success, but like we've said before, you've actually got to do it.
Yes, I think what was surprising was that he came through in such a dominant manner. He'd been knocking at the door, and the people were thinking, well, yeah, you'll win something one day. They didn't all share the confidence of Barry Hearn and the Romford mob, as it was known. But when he did come through, he came through in really spectacular fashion. In the 1980 UK, he beat Terry Griffiths 9-0 in the semi-finals. And then he absolutely slaughtered Alex Higgins 16-6 in the final.
Pretty dominant. And actually, you mentioned Terry there, because the year before he'd been in the final with John Virgo, who arrived late for one of the sessions because they'd changed the time, and he didn't know, or no one had told him, or he just misread it. Or,
well, it was the final session. Right. He was 11-8 up overnight, on the last day, they were playing the last session at noon because the BBC wanted to show it. Somehow or other, this passed John by completely, and he was still in the hotel when people started to ring and say, well, you're on in 10 minutes, where are you? Mm.
Docked two frames, but still won.
Docked two frames, but still won, mm. Yes.
Okay. Well, those sort of early days, I mean, it's worth saying that in those early days, it wasn't a ranking event, the UK Championship. It was only open, I think, to UK and Irish players. It was a UK Championship, but I guess as it became big, it kind of made sense to make it into a ranking tournament. But it's interesting, like Steve Davis, if those counted, would now be on over 30 ranking titles.
Well, he would. Yeah. I think that it became a ranking title when Steve Davis threatened not to enter unless it was made into a full ranking event. It was overdue. It did need to be a ranking event. And after all, restricting it to UK players was only keeping out one or two in those days. Mm. Cliff Thorburn got quite upset about this.
Yeah, well, you can understand it. 1983 was possibly, you could argue, the first sort of great UK final that people now would still talk about years later. Alex Higgins and Steve Davis, the great sort of rivalry, the great clash of personalities. Davis is 7-0 up, and I'm sure there was an expectation that Steve would not lose from 7-0 up, but Alex came back and won in a decider.
The background to that was quite interesting because Higgins was in matrimonial difficulty. It looked as if his marriage was going to break up, but he didn't want it to. And things started to turn around halfway through the tournament, actually, when Lynn, his wife, actually did turn up. So that sort of gave him a new lease of life in a way. But 7-0 down, as you say, was not the most promising of starts. But somehow or other, it all changed round in the evening session, which was the second of four, and Higgins won, I think it was 7 out of 8 in that session, and eventually he fell behind again on the second day, but he ended up winning by the odd frame.
Mm. And it must have played a part in then that 2 years later or 18 months later when Davis lost to Dennis Taylor in the World Final, because it's basically identical.
Yeah, I think it shook Steve's sense of certainty. Mm. You think, there is nobody in the world who can beat me if I'm 7-0 up. Mm. And Higgins proved that someone could. Mm. And I think that it sort of might have lodged like a piece of grit in the back of his mind when it came down to the 85 final, in which he led Dennis Taylor 8-0.
Mm. Probably Alex Higgins' best win over Davis. It's interesting, though. I mean, I really enjoyed the Rat Pack, but there's no mention of that in that. You'd have thought that would have formed part of that story, but maybe they just wanted to concentrate on the World Championship. I don't know. We'll move on a couple of years. Again, Steve in the final. Again, he's trailing Willie Thorne, 13-8. And this is, I don't know how many times Willie's reminded of this or people talk about it, but he had a blue that seemed unmissable, and if he pots it 14-8, he's going to win, isn't he? But he missed it and he didn't win.
Well, Willie was playing pretty well at that time. You don't get 13-8 up on Davis unless you are playing well. Mm. But he missed this blue in the first frame of the final session. Just needed, I think, pink in addition to go to 14-8, and he collapsed. Davis, great predator that he is, smelt blood, and I think he was not exactly resigned to defeat starting the last session, but he would have recognised that it was very much a possibility, a likelihood even, but. It all changed around completely when Willie missed the blue, and Davis ended up winning 16-14. Willie only won one more frame.
I think this is one of the reasons that snooker, you know, remains so popular. You don't get this in every sport where it can literally be one moment like that, just one moment, one miss, that just completely turns everything, and that seed of doubt in Willie's mind. I mean, he loses the frame, he's still 13-9, that's a good lead, but it's the circumstance, how it's happened, and he just obviously couldn't get out of his mind.
He would have had the terrible thought, wouldn't it be terrible if... Mm. There was a similar incident a few years later in the semi-final when Steve was playing Gary Wilkinson. Mm. What happened was that in the penultimate frame, Davis needed a snooker on the pink, but Wilkinson didn't think that he did need a snooker. The pink was left on the balk cushion, and Wilkinson attempted a very nasty ultra thin safety, missed the pink altogether. Whereas if he'd realised that Steve still needed a snooker, he would simply have doubled it over the back down the table. So of course, Steve, great predator that he is, won that frame, won the decider, and won the tournament.
Yeah, and holds the record still for most UK wins, 6, and he got to the final again in 2005, lost to Ding. Still in the 80s, one of the great moments, I think, of the whole history of the tournament was Doug Mountjoy winning for the second time. He won in 78 when he was a top player, and by 1988 he was supposedly declining. He was 46, he was going down the rankings, and normally at that age you just keep going. But he teamed up with Frank Callan, the coach, and he won the tournament, beat Stephen Hendry in the final, but more than that, played fantastically well.
Well, Frank Callan, who was a great coach, the father of modern coaching, actually, he remodelled Doug's game. Doug applied himself to the maximum. He really put the work in, and his form was a complete transformation of what it had been the previous season. And I remember after he'd won the tournament, he paid tribute to Frank Callan and said, "I'm nothing without that guy."
Mm. And he did. I mean, he had 3 centuries in a row at one point, which is impressive now, but back then that was very unusual. Mm. And also Hendry, okay, he was still a teenager, but he'd kind of been earmarked as, you know, the next big star, and I guess was expected to win. So. Mm. An incredible achievement, and then of course he went and won the next event, the Mercantile Classic as well, so no one could say, well, you couldn't say it anyway, but it certainly wasn't a sort of a lucky break. I mean, he was playing great stuff.
Well, he was full of confidence. The UK was a very big deal for him. He was full of confidence, and he was able to maintain his status as a top player for a couple of years before, of course, eventually age did catch up with him.
Mm. Well, it didn't take Hendry long to start winning the tournament next year, in fact, because he never played Steve Davis in a world final, but he played him in 2 UK finals, beat him in 89, but the one people remember is 1990, because it went to a decider, and Hendry showed his kind of mettle under pressure, and I guess it was the passing of the torch. I mean, he was already world champion, but this was kind of confirming this is the new era now.
Yes, and what I remember about that match was that in the penultimate frame, Hendry needed blue, pink and black to equalise at 15 all, and he played an absolutely brilliant rest shot, screwing back. To this day remains one of the best rest shots I've ever seen.
Mm. Yeah, and again, doing it under pressure. I mean, as you say, he's 15-14 down, you know, he misses it, he's probably over, but that didn't seem to bother him. He thrived under that environment.
No, he would say, the shot is this, and this is what I'm going to play.
Mm. Very much like a master chef when he decided what he was going to cook. It didn't work out quite so well, though, did it? In that, but we'll gloss over that. I think it's worth saying that a lot of, sort of new snooker fans or younger people might not appreciate quite what a big deal the UK Championship was in terms of the format, with the longer matches and a 2-day final in those days. It was basically a mini World Championship.
Yes, but the problem with the 2-day final was that if somebody got a very big lead, it left you with little or no final session, so that's why it was trimmed down to a 1-day final.
Mm. Jimmy White, as we know, never won the World Championship, but he won the UK Championship in 1992, and he beat John Parrott, who'd beaten him the year before. And again, you know, we talk about Jimmy White and his popularity, but that was, in a snooker sense, a big deal, because it was one of those events that you kind of have to win to be regarded as a great.
Yeah, everybody forgets that Jimmy won the Masters back in the '80s. I mean, it must like seem like a different life now.
Well, he said he doesn't remember the '80s, so we'll maybe have to remind him he won it. Yeah, but we mentioned that the 2-day final that actually ended that year when Jimmy won it, 92. That was the last one, and the next year, 93, a 17-year-old by the name of Ronnie O'Sullivan ran through the field and won the tournament, beat Hendry in the final. It's one thing to win a tournament, but to win the UK Championship, which is one of the most prestigious in the game, to beat Stephen Hendry, the world champion, in the final. I mean, that's some way to arrive on the scene, isn't it?
It is, but it was the kind of thing that was almost expected of Ronnie by the people who knew him. He was not just being... Well, he was being talked up as a future world champion, but he was showing that, you know, that was very much, you know, what his standard was. And when it came to the final, it didn't come as a complete surprise for him, put it that way. Yeah. And he played it as he plays all his matches, as just a snooker match, not on what's expected of him, but, you know, this is the shot to play now and now and now. And he beat Hendry 10-6. Hendry thought he might feel the pressure of the occasion, but he said he certainly didn't.
Mm. It's interesting. I mean, many people have tried to unravel the O'Sullivan enigma, ourselves included. But I suppose age maybe comes into it, but the fearlessness that he seemed to have, you know, like you say, just another match, not thinking about what it meant. I mean, that's a skill in itself, because most people would do.
Yeah.
At any age.
Yeah. I think only a very few practitioners in any sport have that. They just feel within themselves they are the best, regardless of results. Almost they are the best. They're going to play that way as if they are the best.
Mm. Stephen Hendry was the best the year after. He made 7 centuries in the final against Ken Doherty, best of 19 final. And again, that would be incredible now, but back then, well, the incredible thing in some ways was not that he made them, because he was a century machine. It was the fact that I think he made 7. He was only 7-5 up. He was playing Ken, who kind of won the scrappier frames. Maybe that says something about Hendry's game. It was all about scoring.
Yeah, but what a scorer! The previous year he made 5 centuries and 8 frames, which was another record in his semi-final against John Parrott at Preston.
Mm. This sort of time, like you said, the tournaments, it started to move around. It left Preston, I think 98, when John Higgins won in Bournemouth. And Bournemouth's a great venue, but it would be like when the Masters left the Conference Centre, or had to leave because they knocked it down. It slightly lost something in terms of its identity as a tournament.
Yeah, you know, I can hardly remember anything of the Bournemouth UKs because I associate the UK so much with Preston, and now we're starting to associate it with York. It's built up a sort of base there, but I can hardly remember anything of the Bournemouth UKs.
Yeah, well, I think it was Preston. It must have been the UK Championship, Clive, when you fell out the commentary box, which is worth a story worth telling again. You're on with Dennis Taylor, and you're on a chair, not unlike the one you're on now, with wheels on it, which is kind of... If you haven't heard this story before, you can probably work out how this happened. You were leaning back, I think.
Yeah, I made some remark or other, and I leant back without really thinking that the chair was on wheels, and I started to go backwards. I simply fell backwards out of the commentary box door, but for throwing out my left hand instinctively and grabbing Dennis's tie, which he was never able to unravel, incidentally. but it did save me, possibly, from quite a bit of injury.
Yes, although you inflicted a little bit of injury on Dennis, who struggled to speak. But I think the frame was coming to an end, though, so you had to sort of wrap the frame up.
I got up at the count of 3, I think, or 4, and picked up the commentary.
Let's go back to the tournament. Obviously, Judd Trump, in more recent years, he made his breakthrough at the World Championship, but he didn't win that tournament, so he had to back it up the next season. Beat Mark Allen in a great final, which showcased him as a top player, but also underlined the sort of the way the game has become so attacking, because it was just a match of breaks, really.
Yes, and I remember Trump led 8-3, and Allen got it back to 8-all before Trump won 10-8. But the thing with having a big lead like that in a match which is consisting largely of breaks, it's a big lead, but it can go quite quickly if you're having all these breaks inflicted on you.
Mm, yeah. But again, I mean, we'll talk about the Triple Crown in a minute because I want to discuss whether that's kind of overdone as a thing, but it's the only one he's won so far. So, you know, we talked in a previous podcast about his sort of state of his career at the moment at the age of 28. These are the tournaments to be regarded as great players. Like I was saying with Jimmy, you've got to win one. I mean, it's not easy, obviously, but you've got to win one.
Well, he's certainly capable, and I think he's matured as a match player, and I think he will win a world title. I think he will win a Masters, but of course there's a lot of very good players trying to stop him.
Yeah, absolutely. One interesting thing about the UK Championship is, and this doesn't apply to the World Championship, you could argue, I mentioned Mountjoy, he's maybe the exception that proves the rule, not really shock winners of this tournament. You know, you look at the list and you think, yeah, these are players you probably should be winning it.
Well, I think it's because something to do with the number of frames played. Mm. At the start, every match, first round, second round, was best of 17. Then it was cut to the early rounds, best of 11. But that's still more than, you know, the best of 7 as we sometimes see now, best of 9. And I think a combination of the number of frames and the prestige of the tournament means that there are very, very few really unexpected winners. In fact, I can't think of one.
No, as I'm saying, like, I think Mountjoy, because of the, I mean, he'd won it before, because of the position in his career, it was a surprise he won it. Mm. But he was still he's still a top player of previous years.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that the World Championship, though, is over a longer format, and yet we've had shock winners of that, you could argue.
You've exploded my argument.
Well, the thing is, the people who won it, they were shocked with, I mean, Joe Johnson and Graham Dott, I suppose, are the two examples. Sean Murphy maybe coming through as a qualifier, but they're still great players. It's not like they were complete nobodies. I mean, they've been around and they've been in finals. Mm. Do you think, though, that, I mean, you mentioned that they cut it from best of 17, that happened a good few years ago now. Mm. Has that downgraded the tournament?
I don't think so. I think matches are won and lost on the key frames, aren't they? And whether this comes at 7-all in a best of 17 or 4-all in a best of 11, you know, it's still the same. It still draws those special qualities out of the best players.
Mm. And obviously, one thing that, I mean, there's a lot of tournaments now on the calendar, but one thing the UK has in its favour is its history. Like a lot of the guys who are playing now, the Selbys and so on, Murphy, will have grown up watching a lot of the moments we've mentioned. So it's not like I think the problem in the public mind with a lot of the newer events is they're new, so they don't have any, what is the China Championship to anybody? What's the International Championship? Yeah. Whereas this means something.
Yeah, the Chinese events in particular seem indistinguishable, but with the UK, for example, with a 40-year history, that sort of impresses on the contenders the importance of it, the desirability of winning it, if you like.
Mm. What about this thing? So coming up to the UK this year, it's at the Barbican, which I think is a great venue, but they take all the players there and they have two venues in one. So you have the main hall, which is lovely, and then the other arena, which has been described as all sorts of things, including a toilet, which is maybe a little overstating it slightly. But it's sort of apartheid, really, isn't it? It's basically saying you're not, you know, to the players who go in there, you're not significant enough to play in the main arena. It can't be nice.
No, but it is the alternative, which would be playing at least one round at Preston or Barnsley or somewhere. Is that any better? It's a choice of imperfect alternatives.
Mm, absolutely. I mentioned the Triple Crown. I mean, we talk about the UK, the Masters, the World. They're the three longest running professional tournaments, and they've been sort of grouped together for quite a while. And there's, I think it's 10 players that have won all three. But it seems it's talked about more than ever now. And I wonder if it's because the BBC now only show three events, so they sort of say, well, our three are almost, you know, the only ones that kind of matter. Is it over, sort of done?
Possibly, although you can't argue with the fact that those three events are the longest running in the snooker calendar, the World, the Masters and the UK. They are the senior events.
Mm. But I just wonder if it's slightly kind of just slightly overstated. I mean, there's players who, for example, Ray Reardon, for example, never won the UK Championship, but that doesn't lessen his kind of career, does it? I don't think.
No, well, he won six world championships, so that was some compensation.
Mm. I guess it's a goal for players. I mean, Sean Murphy was very proud, obviously, to join that club, and it kind of means something to them. So, is it still as big as ever, the UK? Now there's so many tournaments. Is it just another event, or does it still stand out?
No, I think it still stands out. I think it's underneath the World Championship clearly, but I think because of its history and the exposure it gets, there's something special about it.
Mm. Do you have any specific memories of the Preston years? I seem to remember you told the story about you're watching some match that was so bad that you preferred to watch the rain running down the window. maybe not a treasured memory, but a memory nonetheless.
Yeah, I was working for BBC Radio at the time, and it was the only match left in the arena, and I will name and shame the players involved.
Absolutely,
Darren Morgan and Jason Ferguson,
chairman.
Now the chairman,
yeah.
Of WPBSA, and it was very, very slow, and I was on air every half hour because there's no other sport on.
Mm.
There was hardly any, the frames were so long and nothing much to say about them, and I grew fascinated with watching raindrops run up and down the windows, which was possibly just as entertaining as the play.
Yeah, and you could probably get ranking points now for rain running down the window, and you can get it for everything else. Well, the UK, like you say, because of its history and the role of honour, it is. I think it is still a big event, and I think a lot of people would like to see the best of 17s return, but that's not going to happen, is it? It is what it is now.
Yeah, I think that you've got to cram the matches into the time available.
Mm. Okay, well, that's it. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with more.